Welcome to Season 2 of The Great Humbling. My name's Dugald Hine. I'm a writer and co-founder of a school called Home. Through the strange spring of 2020, I kept a weekly appointment with the futurist Ed Gillespie, where we would puzzle our way through the stories taking shape around the pandemic and how all this fits into a longer arc of social, political, and ecological crisis. We called these conversations The Great Humbling because we started from a sense that this is a time of being humbled, brought down to earth. And we wanted to ask what happens if we approach the moment we're in on those terms. Now we're back for a second season, where each week we'll be taking a state of mind that seems to be part of the mix of being alive just now. So this is The Great Humbling Season 2, Altered States. States of being, states of consciousness, and of course, the literal alteration of our nation states. Thanks for listening. Okay, here we are, episode 5. Ed, I've got a question for you. Are you paying attention?
I am paying attention, Dougald, and I'm angry.
Are you? Good, because if you're not angry, you're not paying attention, apparently, right?
Apparently.
Well, listen, that's our state this week, isn't it? We're trying to conjure ourselves into a state of anger. I tell you what I do pay. I pay to get emails from a very angry man. There's a guy called Mick Wright, who has a newsletter on Substack called Conquest of the Useless. And I should say that I picked it up via Chris TT's newsletter, The Border Crossing, which is also highly recommended. But Conquest of the Useless is a more or less daily commentary on the state of the British media. Spoiler, it's a shit show.
There's no prizes for guessing that one.
Well, what's interesting is Mick Wright is a journalist who has this love-hate relationship with his own profession and writes very honestly about it. I mean, he loves what it's meant to be. He hates what it mostly is. I subscribed to the free version and was enjoying it enough that I ended up becoming a paying subscriber. So that's a bit of a compliment, really, to give money to get angry incoming email. At least I think if it was directed at me, then I might react differently. But what strikes me often reading Mick's mails is the role that Twitter plays in all of this. And maybe it's just because it's so long since I was a journalist that I can't quite relate to the role that Twitter plays in journalism these days, the way in which people are constantly on it, the way in which drama spills in and out of that space. And it's funny because if you Googled Beginner's Guide to Twitter around this time last decade, then on the front page of results was a blog post that I wrote, which was actually written for one of my old BBC colleagues at the point where everyone was suddenly going, oh, you've got to get Twitter. You've got to get on Twitter. And I always used to say to people in those days, you know, how long was it from when somebody first showed you Google to when you got why Google was good? And then how long was it from when someone first showed you Twitter to when you got why Twitter was good? This was the social difference. It's the layer on top of the technical functionality of a good search engine. You know, with Twitter, so much of it is not just there in the technology, but in the ways of using it that people have and had. And 10 years ago, I loved Twitter. It was responsible for all kinds of serendipities in my life. 3 years ago, I left it for good. I still have an account, but I don't touch it. And part of that was just the sense of the kind of tide of anger, occasionally personally directed at me, more often directed at people I knew, or just generally in the background atmosphere. And when I wrote that beginner's guide, I said, you know, think of Twitter as an endless rolling pub conversation that you can dip in and out of. And it just felt like the pub had gone downhill and the guy with the big mouth at the bar now also had his finger on the nuclear button. And it was kind of time to get out of that That scene.
I mean, when I first started using Futero and running an agency, there was an amazing sense that you could share stuff. And where we used to have to work quite hard in order to distribute and get stuff out there, suddenly, you know, in what's felt like hours, you'd have 20,000 views of something. And it was like, oh, wow, this is extraordinary. You know, this is completely disintermediating things. And it was fantastic. But I think we all have a Twitter hate storm story, don't we?
I'm not going to tell mine.
You're not going to tell yours. Okay. So my Twitter hate storm story, which I think is worth sharing because it's an act of contrition on my part as well, actually happened on the hottest day on record in the UK last year when it was pipping 38.7 degrees. And interestingly, there's also a kind of fairly linear relationship between rising temperatures and rising anger. If you look at the research, actually, as things get hotter, so do our tempers. You know, get all sorts of aspects of that, from increased aggression to heightened threat perception to raised hostility and even escalating violence itself. So it's not surprising that this all happened on a day when we were perhaps all a bit feverish. And I was on a train to the epicenter of the heatwave in Cambridge, where that hottest temperature was recorded. And a chap got on, stripped down to his shorts, hung his sweaty singlet on a peg, got out his laptop and started to work. And I should add at this point, you know, that the train was actually air conditioned. It wasn't actually very hot in the train itself. Anyway, I took a photo and rather stupidly, blithely tweeted it with the caption, "I know it's hot, but really?" Question mark. And to cut a long story short, you know, it was obviously an image which seemed to sum up that heatwave day on Twitter, and it very rapidly went viral, and to my abject horror had over like 5,000 retweets and responses, including from the poor bloke in question. So I ended up, you know, profusely apologising for not pixelating his face. It was a pretty crass error on my part, admittedly. You know, I shouldn't have taken a covert picture and published it without his permission. I didn't preserve his right to anonymity. I ended up making a donation to charity, deleting the tweet, you know, and was basically suitably chastised by the whole experience. But I think what was really horrific, actually, was the descent of the Twitter mob, the angry mob, within minutes. I mean, I was basically accused, trialed, convicted as guilty of everything from body shaming to hate crime. People edited my Wikipedia page. They contacted my publisher demanding I be blacklisted. They copied various clients of mine into tweets and generally attempted to destroy my so-called career. And it was just righteous anger incarnate. And it's hard to describe how that hate feels. And my experience was relatively mild compared to the opprobrium that gets ladled onto some others. But it gave me a sort of newfound empathy for those on the receiving end of this sort of biliousness.
Everything you say is making me glad that I kept my vow to leave Twitter behind. I think when I left in 2017, there were various events that triggered it, but one was just realizing I had written 300,000 words over the previous 12 years on Twitter.
It's three books, Dougald.
That's what I said. I said, I plan on writing 300,000 words in the next 10 years. I said it to Alan Garner and he said, yes, but not as confetti.
That's what a beautiful image.
Then I told that to Bill Thompson, who is a wonderful, prolific user of social media. And he said, yes, but the reason why there's confetti is because there's been a wedding, which was a nice comeback. But I stuck to my... stuck to my guns, more like stuck to my self-disarmament. I would wonder if you get cancelled on Twitter and you never go there anymore. It's a bit like a tree falling in a forest.
I think there is confetti, but, you know, it's the confetti after the wedding when it's sort of wet and mashed up and stuck to the bottom of your shoe, not fluttering, you know, gaily through the air.
It's the kind of not very eco-friendly confetti that's just clogging up the drains, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, I wonder what they'll say on Twitter about this. I'll never know. Like, this whole thread set me thinking about another post by John Michael Greer, the Trump-friendly archdruid who I introduced with some caveats the other week. He wrote a very interesting essay a while back called "Hate is the New Sex," comparing the treatment of hate as an emotion to the treatment of sex in the 19th century. And it's, you know, it's quite a convincing argument that he makes. He says, if you want to slap the worst imaginable label on an organization, you call it a hate group. If you want to push a category of discourse straight into the realm of the utterly unacceptable, you call it hate speech. If you're speaking in public and you want to be sure that everyone in the crowd will beam approval at you, all you have to do is denounce hate. And he's like, this is exactly how Victorians talked about sex, and it's got the same kind of hypocrisy built into it, because, you know, the same people who will talk in this way about hate will also often be very quick to join in a Twitter mob. And people say, you know, well, you can't compare the unpleasantness of a Twitter mob getting carried away with itself to the physical threat of violence coming from people on the right in American society in particular. And absolutely. But there's something worth thinking about here nonetheless. And if I think about that passage that I quoted from Greer, I guess what it's asking for is not that we stop pointing to the things that we're pointing to when we use a phrase like hate group or hate speech necessarily, but that we find a more precise way of explaining what it is we are talking about that doesn't simply repress the feeling of hate as something that is never, ever okay. Mm. And Greer has a lot of fun with this slogan, love trumps hate, which was apparently a popular sticker among Clinton supporters in the 2016 election. And you can read that phrase more than one way, let's say. And his suggestion is that in some kind of Freudian sense, there is a current of unhealthy connection to loving Trump's hatefulness amongst some of those who would think of themselves as the biggest opponents of Trump, which is an interesting thought, let's say. And like I hinted at last week, I think we're going to have to do a show where we home in on the current US election, albeit with the humility of people watching it from a long way away who do not have the skin in the game that so many other people do. But I do think there's something more general about the role of anger and rage and wrath and fury and hate. And on the one hand, this thing that hate is the biggest no-no. And on the other hand, the kind of moral authority of anger, in particularly in online culture. And as I say that, I find myself hesitating, because there's another voice in my head which says, well, if I'm not as angry as Mick Wright or whoever else, isn't that a symptom of my privilege, my ability to get away with not paying attention?
Well, I mean, it could well be, Dougald. I mean, I think it's worth remembering, you know, that anger is a secondary emotion. You know, and it's completely valid as a feeling in its own right, but it's often also a way of protecting ourselves from feeling other vulnerable emotions, you know. And the other bit in John Michael Greer's article that I liked is when he's talking about, I mean, it's essentially a projection, if you like, from one side to the other. So there was another poster he refers to, it was put up by Democrats, saying Trump hates you. And he sort of dissects that as a projection.
Well, it's like, Greer's like, Trump doesn't know who you are. So in what sense?
Exactly. It's like, actually, it's like, you hate Trump, but your projection is that Trump hates you and is saying that to others. And I thought that was very interesting. Psychologists refer to it as the anger iceberg. Anger is the visible reaction, but underneath the surface, where the majority of the stuff is going on, are so many other feelings, you know, of being afraid, of feeling attacked, being offended, this, you know, the righteous moral indignation that you referred to, being disrespected, or actually some of the more physical, visceral stuff of being forced or being trapped or pressured or persecuted, all of which, I'm guessing, may in principle at least be mitigated by privilege. You know, certainly not automatically, but that on the flip side of that, there's also a lot of angry, privileged people out there now too. And I watched a great talk by the BBC's Director of Creative Diversity, June Sarpong, this week, in which she was talking about how white privilege facilitates ignorance and complicity in racism. And she was challenging the notion that someone has to lose for someone else to win, which seems to run through a lot of this anger that comes from people in relatively privileged positions. And it's, you know, it's a very Trumpian notion, actually. You know, it's not enough for me to win, and you also have to lose. And it's a fear I think we see manifest in the defense of white and, let's face it, largely white male privilege that is clearly expressed as anger.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think about this because we're two white blokes, fairly privileged settings, chatting to each other on the internet each week. And I want to own that. And also own this sense that you get from a lot of the feminist thinkers who have really influenced me, that on the one hand, if we want to talk in the language of the patriarchy, let's talk in those terms, knowing that there are other ways of talking. The consequences of patriarchy are not evenly distributed. And on the other hand, even the winners lose. Men are trapped in the expectations of what you're meant to be like to be a man. And that is true at the same time as men benefit from this system. And maybe part of the desire to step back from the heat of anger, and this is like Gordon White's thing that I talked about the other week of sort of bumping it up to the next dimension, is the need to hold complex truths like that together, and how difficult that it gets to hold that together once we're really, you know, seeing the red mist. And this all takes me back to Alistair McIntosh and the impact that his book Soil and Soul made on me when I was 25. Because as I read it, I realized that lots of the activism I'd encountered and been part of up to that point seemed to be driven by anger. And the notable exception was the amazing old white-haired Quaker women who I met who'd come through the peace movement and so on. But what I'd started to notice by 25 was that you could be driven by anger and full of life when you're 19 or 25. But it was a lot rarer to meet people who have that combination of anger and fullness of life at 39 or 45. I mean, Alistair's argued this in various points, not least in the essay that he wrote for us for the first issue of Dark Mountain. Not a little of that activist anger has its roots in unresolved issues with our own parents. Mm. I say at this point, I'm lucky in that respect, not least in that my mum is now an old white-haired or sometimes purple-haired Quaker woman in her own right. But what I got from Alistair was a model of an activist passion that was not grounded in anger alone. It didn't stigmatize anger, but it said you need to be able to tap into something deeper. If you're going to keep your flame alight past youth, then you're going to need a deeper source of fuel than your own anger for that. And that's been a very important compass point for me since.
I really love that idea of a deeper source of fuel, as long as it's not from a deep coal mine. But now, I remember my first years in Brixton in the late 90s and early noughties, when the radical activist website Urban 75 was just starting out. And one of their mottos, and yes, I did buy the t-shirt. I'm pretty sure I bought the t-shirt, which was borrowed from John Lydon, you know, of Sex Pistols and Public Image Limited fame, was anger is an energy. And it certainly is. But we only have to look at like the idioms around anger to get a flavour of how easily it can get out of hand, you know, to be up in arms. I mean, you know, literally that's the militia are descending to blow a fuse or a gasket or to blow your top, to come down on someone like a ton of bricks, to go ballistic, to turn yourself into a weapon or projectile. Your gloves are off. You're being hauled over the coals. You jump down someone's throat.
You're on the warpath.
You're on the warpath. Exactly. I mean, you know, there's so much violence in the imagery of just those classic idioms and phrases. And you just mentioned the red mist, you know, and I think when the red mist descends, which seems eerily reminiscent of the skies over the San Francisco Bay Area during fire season right now, or there's also the stuff around the fact that we acknowledge how it compromises us. You know, when we talk about the blindness, the blind rage, the blind fury, the unsighted, uncontrollable eye for an eye, Old Testament vengeance, which runs through that thread. And as always, it's good to dig into the etymology a little bit. interestingly, in the context of the secondary emotion aspect and the kind of anger iceberg I was talking about before, anger actually comes from the Old Norse anger, meaning grief or vex. So it comes from pain. You know, its root is literally in pain, which is why anger management is all about recognizing those underlying feelings behind the anger, the injustice, the threat, the sense of outrage and upset, and responding to those in a way that isn't just about boiling away in your own vitriol. And Aristotle put it well. He said, anybody can become angry. Being angry is easy. But to be angry with the right person and to the right degree and at the right time and for the right purpose and in the right way, that is not within everybody's power. And it's not easy.
I like that. Yeah. The idea that there might be a discipline of careful anger.
Mm.
There's a book about Alan Garner called A Fine Anger. That idea of a refined anger, there's something very potent in that. It's something actually, weirdly, I see that in Rowan Williams' writing. There's a book called Lost Icons that he wrote before he was Archbishop of Canterbury that has that quality to it. It's interesting, too, about those meanings of anger in Old Norse. I didn't know that, but I realize it's actually there in Swedish today. The verb att ångra sig is to change your mind, to regret something.
Mm.
It's lingering there. And I can't help imagining that angst belongs to the same set of words as well. So there's a kind of knot of feelings there.
Mm.
Hugh Brody, in one of his books, he's an anthropologist who's worked with and on behalf of indigenous tribal peoples. He talks about how in Inuit culture, anger is childish. No grown-up would allow their unmastered anger to express itself. The ease with which we flare up into anger is one of the things that makes white people look like children from the perspective of many indigenous cultures that place, you know, even greater emphasis than Aristotle on the cultivation, not the suppression of your emotions, but the tuning of your ability to, you know, in a lot of cultures, they say children are born, but grown-ups are made.
Mm.
And sometimes it's like we don't have very many grown-ups in our culture. But there's a wonderful essay that was on the Dark Mountain online edition this week that offered me a path through what we're talking about here with anger. It's an essay called Sick by Kate Chapman, who's a wonderful poet, a Dark Mountain editor, and she's writing about her journey with chronic illness over the past few years. And as I was reading it, I was thinking, if anyone has the right to be angry, isn't it someone whose life as a young person, a dedicated activist, is interrupted unfairly in her early 30s by a mysterious and debilitating condition? And she writes about this honestly, like the edges are not smoothed off in the piece that she's written. And she draws the connections between her experience of chronic illness and the chronic illness of our culture and the chronic illness of a planet in a time of climate change and all the rest. And I just want to read you a bit, actually, from this essay, because I think it's got some clues for what it looks to go beyond anger in a way which is not simply a privileged ability to not be paying attention. Here's how she writes. In some ways, it's undeniably true that I am now more or less just the ghost of Kate Chapman, haunting my own ruined life. But it's also true that in some ways I'm more alive in the world than I ever was before I got sick. So much of the bullshit values of social conventions have been ripped away in this rude, sudden, painful descent to the underworld. Ill health can bring with it a deepening of compassion, solidarity, and a felt appreciation that both our joys and our sufferings are subject to changes utterly beyond our control. Of course, I wouldn't wish myself chronically ill, any more than I'd wish anyone else chronically ill. But there is nonetheless a real and deep blessing in this. Equally, Few could wish to live through these end times, watching a civilization slowly implode, and in doing so taking so many others down with it. But here we are. So we can't afford to not get angry. And we can't afford to stay angry, to get stuck there. I think it's something like that that I'm reaching towards.
I love that line that Kate quotes from, again, from Alistair McIntosh's Soil and Soul, where he says, "No place is more sacred, no peoples more worthy of honour than those that have made beauty blossom anew out of desecration." It's a phenomenal thought. And then Kate responds to that. She said, "This work of beauty making can take place in many contexts, both with and without an audience, praise and recognition, with and without far-reaching impacts." And that, to me, speaks to a possible answer to your question. You know, we can't afford not to get angry, and we can't afford to stay angry. So how do we navigate that? And I think it's about feeling the anger. And again, in that Inuit story you just shared, it's feeling the anger. To feel the anger is okay, but to recognize it and to respect it and to understand its origins, but then express it differently, or perhaps not to express it directly at all, but to know that something has moved in you. It really reminds me of Sarah Corbett's beautiful and profound craftivist work, you know, and her notion is, if we want our world to be more beautiful, kind and fair, then shouldn't our activism itself be more beautiful, kind and fair? And she's sort of triggered a whole global movement that brings heads, hearts and hands together in a really beautiful way. And it's almost like an antidote to anger, even though it's still born from a similar frustration. And her manifesto is like a checklist of how to comprehend what lies beneath and channel it more effectively. So it's all about breathing and taking it slowly. Solidarity, not sympathy. So, you know, to stand shoulder to shoulder rather than to patronize. She says empathy never points fingers. And obviously a notion which will chime with both of us is humility is the key. And I worked with Sarah on some mini fashion statements, which we playfully did, which were tiny handwritten scrolls with messages on them around ethical fashion. And they were beautifully made and tied with a tiny ribbon and then secreted into the clothing pockets of friends or colleagues or in clothes in shops to be discovered and inspire curiosity and thought and action around beauty beyond the garment itself. And that came from, you know, a very strong sense of anger about the, and this was triggered after Rana Plaza. It was coming from an anger in the system. But what we wanted to do was to get people to start to ask the questions themselves, and the scrolls and their surprise appearance when you stuck your hand in a pocket and pulled it out and went, "What is this tiny, beautiful object?" seemed to be a very creative and gentle, kind and compassionate way of expressing some very complex and difficult truths.
There's something here about the fine anger, the refined anger, the beauty made out of the heat of anger. And I can recognize in myself the times when I haven't let the heat in to be able to forge the beauty, maybe because of a fear of the way I used to get angry when I was young. I can remember what an explosive young man I was, how over stupid things in arguments with friends, I could escalate this kind of verbal anger, and then I'd be carrying it around. And the older I got, the more I noticed that I'd be carrying it for hours or days in my chest after that kind of explosion of anger. But as always, the challenge is to find the subtle path between, rather than to go to the opposite extreme of just shutting it down, because then there can be a coolness in you that prevents you really connecting with the deep source of, you know, of anger and beauty and gentleness.
Just the imagery again of what you're talking about there, it's like we talk about being forged in anger, you know, so anger being used in that heat of that anger being used, but to craft something rather than, you know, a furnace which is roaring out of control. It's not an inferno. It's not a conflagration, but we're talking about the craft of the forge of the furnace, which is perhaps where the effective refined anger lies.
Right. And fire isn't bad. fire is dangerous. Something that is dangerous is bad when it's in the wrong place. And maybe this is the bit of truth that I'm getting from the John Michael Greer piece, is he's saying, you know, we've got hate categorized as bad rather than as dangerous. You know, actually, like sex can be dangerous because we're very, very vulnerable, like physically, but in lots of other ways. And, you know, we don't necessarily have great literacy around that in our societies. But part of that is because we're recovering from a time when we had sex categorized not as dangerous, but as bad, as wrong, as kind of morally, well, as immoral. So a place that I want to kind of help us start to bring this into land from is going back to the work of Vanessa Andreotti. And I realize that Vanessa and Alistair are names that keep coming up, along with Martin Shaw, very often in these conversations. It's not just because the three of them are going to be my guests in the Climate Sessions series that we're doing with A School Called Home that starts next month. It's also because I think it's in the nature of what we're doing in these conversations, that it's not a news-driven churn of takes, but an ongoing ruminative engagement with the work of people who we personally have found helpful in finding our bearings in disorienting times. And so this week I want to bring in a text from Vanessa Andreotti and Elwood Jimmy, a booklet that comes out of this painful experience of when things go wrong between a Canadian arts organisation that wants to indigenise and or decolonise its work and hires an Indigenous person, and it all goes predictably wrong because they don't realize the depth of what they're dealing with, and their good intentions are not enough to substitute for a real understanding of the depth of the mess you're engaging with once you start doing the decolonial work. And the organization feels let down, and the Indigenous person feels scapegoated. And this is, it comes out of the experience of a particular organization, a particular story, but where the people who are writing this are very aware of how often they've seen these patterns. And so obviously what you're talking about there is a situation in which there is anger, there is legitimate grounds for anger, and it's definitely not six of one, half a dozen of the other. You know, there is a real power difference, there is real injustice present within this situation that needs to be named. But the question is, what do you do next? And the process that Vanessa and Elwood went through with the organization in question, and then the material in this short book that came out of it, and you can download the book, it's available as a PDF online. If you search for Towards Braiding, you'll get it. It's all about finding generative ways forward. That's one of the key terms they use, generative. And it's about how to recognize the difficulty and the difference between how things look, depending on the sensibility you're coming from. In this case, settler colonial sensibility on the one side, which they use the image of bricks for. We like building things with bricks, like walls. And on the other side, the threads sensibility that tends to be dominant in a lot of Indigenous cultures, which is much more about weaving. And, you know, and they're not saying bricks are bad, threads are good. They are saying there is a historical injustice that is the starting point where brick sensibilities are prioritized and taken seriously, and everyone else is expected to fit their stuff into that. But the work that they're inviting people to do is to find ways of braiding these different sensibilities, taking good bits from both as appropriate to the context, and in the context of these organizations, creating guidelines that can help this kind of engagement go differently. And then they say, I love this way of describing it, enlivening these guidelines with compassion, including self-compassion, generosity, humility, flexibility, depth, and rigor, and without turning our back to or burning out with the complexities, paradoxes, difficulties, and pain of this work. And what I get from hanging out with Vanessa and her gang is the sense that the ultimate aim is not to build utopia. The ultimate aim is that we find ways to make new mistakes rather than repeating old ones. And that feels like a truly humble basis for attempting to work for change.
Completely does. Again, it's recognizing the emotions and the angers and the difficulties, isn't it? And not trying to dismiss them or shy away from engaging with them, even though they could be quite challenging and problematic, but to work your way through them in some way. Off the back of that, I thought I'd share something which actually made me a little angry this week, which was after last week's conversation around the state of tension, this quote from the actor and activist Mark Ruffalo popped up. And it said, you know, if you're losing hope, then you're not doing enough. Activism is an act of hope, and hope is a discipline. And we can do this because we are here to create the future we want. And I read it and it pissed me off. And of course, after some considered and contemplative self-reflection, I realized it's just because it's triggering me. Because, you know, obviously I frequently feel like I'm not doing enough, as many as are, that I'm losing hope. And then Mark Ruffalo tells me it's because I'm not activist enough. I'm not disciplined enough. You know, and then he echoes, actually, the syllogism that you shared from a government spokesperson at that climate event when you were talking about your early years of activism, who basically said, we'll beat climate change because we have to, therefore it's beatable. And you hear that. And I think that's where I still get triggered. That's where my anger starts to come from, I guess. And I think one thing, you know, you were saying the fire that you held and you physically held it in your chest as a young man. I completely connect with that. And it does feel like it's not as softening as you get older. As you say, I think it's more a kind of a direction or a judicious use of the fire rather than a sort of wild stoking with the poker. And for me, that's mellowed through a lot of the writing I've done, particularly the poetry, which has allowed some catharsis, or perhaps some of the, not the draining of the heat, but as I say, the directing of the heat in a way that means you're not in that explosive set of idioms we described before.
Yeah, I'm listening to that Mark Ruffalo quote, and I'm thinking sometimes that's true. Sometimes what you need is absolutely to take the next action, and that's, you know, rather than ruminating your way out of a hole. But sometimes the opposite is true as well. Like sometimes activism can become a form of distraction, a way that we avoid sitting with what we're really feeling. Mm. And this to me, again, is one of the key Dark Mountain journeys, that, you know, despair is not a thing to be avoided at all costs, and nor is despair an end in itself. Like the kind of hope worth having is the kind that lies on the far side of despair. And I hope it's clear that I don't speak to disparage activism. I hope it's clear that I speak for something very other than what Donald Trump stands for, despite quoting from people who would be a lot more enthusiastic about him and critical of his opponents than I am. But maybe a place that I can end this from my side this week is a story that came from a friend of mine, the amazing Emma Wallace. She wrote this on Facebook the other day about her experiences when she first moved to the Pyrenees over a decade ago, picking up hitchhikers. And she said, I was trying on different identities, different answers to the, so what do you do question? Like gardener, architect, accountant, doctor, teacher, carpenter, nurse. And she says she quickly found that one answer generated a stronger response than others. And it was when she said, I'm an artist. And she describes this kind of sequence of things that she'd see like flaring in people in their response. And the first, there's a kind of life force, a kind of quickening coming alive in response to this. And then very quickly off the back of that, there's a sort of money, fame force. Have I heard of you? So do you sell lots of paintings? And then a kind of bitterness, a sort of what's the point? An attacking response. And these days, Emma tends to describe herself as a monk, a queer monk. And she says, With my monk hat on, people tell me their deepest secrets, that most of them want to be a work of art. With my artist hat on, people can get very sad and angry and unkind, primarily because they want to be a work of art and think they can't be. And like jealous people in pain, they're mean to the artist in us all.
That's beautiful. No, that's really lovely. I had a friend on a slightly more playful level who used to play a similar game when he was hitchhiking. And once got himself painted into a corner because he made up a job in which he was a diver testing the thickness of ships' hulls. And the conversation went on and he was completely winging it in a sort of as a creative game until the guy said, "So who do you work for?" And he sort of stumbled and blurted out, "Allied Hulls." He said, at which point, you know, he could tell that the game was up as the guy clearly rumbled him. So I will finish actually on a similarly playful note with this piece, which I think brings us back to our anger. I spotted this courtesy of Tom Hirons of Hedge Spoken Press and author of Sometimes a Wild God Infamy. And it's a classic piece of McSweeney's internet tendency riffing by a guy called John K. Peck on the slightly hoary old adage about the two wolves inside of you, which I'm sure listeners will have come across. And it basically goes, "There are two wolves inside you," said the old man. "They are fighting to the death. One is anger and one is love. And which one will win?" says the young boy. "Whichever one you feed," said the old man. And John K. Peck has had some great fun with this, so I thought I'd just finish on a couple of them. "There are two wolves inside you," said the old man. "You cannot withstand the storm," said the devil. "Try to avoid mixing metaphors," said the English teacher. "I am the storm," said the wolf, before throwing its head back and howling at the single unblinking eye of the moon. Or this one, slightly more reductionist. "There is one wolf inside you." "Was it truly a victory if my opponent was undernourished?" asks the wolf. "Do you consider it a victory?" replies the therapist. "I guess. I mean, law of the jungle and all. Still, something about it seems wrong," says the wolf. "That's all we have time for this week," says the therapist. So we'll leave you contemplating the feeding of your own wolves and whether they need therapy or to avoid mixing their metaphors. Thank you for listening to The Great Humbling. We see this podcast as very much an exploration, not a prescription. A provisional investigation that maybe loves questions more than answers to begin with and needs a little time and space to breathe. If you are new to the podcast, please do revisit season one, as we are aiming to build on ideas, insights and narratives already touched upon. And together, this will hopefully enable us all to make a little more sense of these strange times we are living through. Please do comment, ask questions and respond via our Facebook page, The Great Humbling, or via my Twitter account, @Frucool. And we would obviously deeply appreciate and be grateful for any ratings, reviews, recommendations or sharing you might feel compelled to contribute as a result of listening. Our title music is I Recall by Blue Dot Sessions, used gratefully under a Creative Commons license. We're living in a time of humbling, an initiation at a cultural scale. Please join us on this emergent journey.